There's a lot of activity all the time in North Korea, but I'm not going to speculate on what that particular commercial satellite picture shows.
North Korea appears to be preparing for a rocket launch. It's Monday, March 11th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, top Chinese leaders looking for a slowing economy. Australia and Indonesia seek a larger exchange. Courageous women are recognized. An actor you likely have seen. And digging into the gardens of Babylon. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The White House on Sunday says it does not have any illusions about whether North Korea is preparing to resume missile testing, but refused to assess commercial satellite imagery suggesting Pyongyang is assembling a new rocket. National Security Advisor John Bolton told ABC News the U.S. watches North Korea constantly.
The United States government, I'll just put it this way, expends a lot of resources and effort, so we don't have to rely on commercial satellite imagery. We've seen a lot in North Korea. We watch it constantly. I've been doing this since the first Bush administration, George H.W. Bush. There's a lot of activity all the time in North Korea, but I'm not going to speculate on what that particular commercial satellite picture shows.
The imagery seems to show new North Korean missile activity at an assembly operation. Bolton says we see exactly what they're doing. He said, we look every day at the intelligence. I don't want to get into speculation as to what they're doing. Those commercial satellite photos were taken February 22nd, 3 days ahead of the summit meeting between Trump and Kim. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about that with Stephen Norper, the Korea Society Senior Director for Policy and Education and a professor at Columbia University.
Well, certainly the U.S. government has a very high capability, given its satellite imagery, to know in almost real time what's happening in North Korea. And President Trump made it clear that there's a full knowledge of where North Korea is with its development and the locations. And so I think we need to take it in a bit of a cautious light, and that's that there may have been activity, but we shouldn't necessarily equate that with an imminent missile launch or satellite launch. It's clear if it's Sohae and reactivated, they may well have been exercising a negotiating ploy, either with the anticipation that the Americans would see activity and know that going into Hanoi, or in the aftermath that it would show the serious nature for the U.S. calls for checks against missile and nuclear development. So it's hard to say whether it's actual preparation for a satellite launch or whether it's meant to be a negotiation tactic.
There has been some speculation that this could be not a missile, but a rocket launch, the difference being that they might want to launch a satellite or something that doesn't seem as possibly warlike than others. Have you heard that, and what do you think about that?
Well, I have heard that, and I think it's important to remember that we know they have the thrust capability already from their intercontinental ballistic missile test of November of 2017 and in July earlier that year. They have the ability to strike the range of the entirety of the United States. So a satellite launch is different. It means they'll be exercising the thrust capability, but it's different because things like guidance systems and miniaturization, things that would concern one about a missile test, don't apply on a space launch. What it also says is that the U.S. and international community should be thinking, if the North Koreans are looking for an internal legitimizer like a space launch, that there may be ways to have China, Russia, Kazakhstan provide for a launch for North Korea that then mitigates or lessens the U.S. and international community concern about trying to perfect that technology for missile launches.
How much damage, if any, has been done to either side, the U.S. or North Korea, by the failure of the summit meeting?
Well, I think we need to realize that these things take a great deal of time, and denuclearization is a complex process. So I don't think we should write it off as a complete or abject failure at this point. I think there was a walk away from negotiation 2 hours prior to its ending, and there's a process at play, and it's an unusual one because it's a top-led process, and meaning that there hasn't been a lot of preparatory work done. It means that they need to get back to the table for a second or third round of negotiations. Beyond that, this may have just been part A of B or part A of A, B, C. And so there may be an agreement in the offing. It did seem that when they came into it, the North Koreans were willing to give up their Yongbyon nuclear facility, perhaps in its entirety. And they've already done a testing moratorium and until now have had a downtick at the Sohae missile site. So it looks like there has been a perceived progress on their part. There are no missile flying, as the Trump administration has said. And it seemed like the administration was ready to give partial sanctions relief. It's a matter of getting those to match, the U.S. giving partial sanctions relief or some sort of partial declaration and verification regimen.
Do you think North Korea will ever give up its entire nuclear capability?
It's very hard to say. It's their only negotiating card. They find themselves, from their definition, strategically disadvantaged. They say they need a deterrence, and they say that it provides a level of legitimacy. Clearly, we want them to end that because it creates challenges for the nonproliferation regime globally. It's a very bad example elsewhere. But maybe Kim Jong-un is willing to trade that off for economic modernization. And that seems to be what the U.S. administration is pushing for, that there are real, tangible economic results if they do trade that off, that security is not in maintaining nuclear weapons, but in giving that up. And that is what South Korean President Moon Jae-in and his administration has gambled on in terms of inter-Korean reconciliation and trying to push the North and the U.S. towards some agreement on sanctions relief for a commitment to denuclearization.
Asked about the commercial satellite images on Friday, Trump said he would be very disappointed if North Korea resumed nuclear testing. He said he has greatly improved U.S. relations with North Korea during his time in office. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. U.S. says no illusions about possible North Korean missile activity. Tibet supporters mark 60th anniversary of failed uprising against China. Malaysia deports 7 for alleged ties to terrorist group. Cambodian farmers struggle against changing climate. Japanese woman honored by Guinness as oldest person at age 116. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China's Premier Li Keqiang says the world's second largest economy has a tough struggle ahead this year. As China grapples with a slowing economy and the ongoing trade dispute with the United States, it is facing unprecedented severe challenges and risks. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
In his annual government work report to China's largely rubber-stamped National People's Congress, Li Keqiang told delegates about plans to cut taxes to boost the economy and focus on innovation. He also set Beijing's growth target for this year between 6 to 6.5%. The tone of Li's speech was sober, and he mentioned the phrase stabilize or stability more than 70 times. He talked about the need to stabilize the stock market, financial sector, unemployment, expectations, foreign and domestic investment, and, of course, trade frictions with the United States.
As we pursue development this year, we will face a graver and more complicated environment, as well as risks and challenges that are greater in number and size. We must be fully prepared for a tough struggle.
Trade tensions and tariffs are adding to the challenges Beijing is facing. The United States' request to extradite tech giant Huawei's chief financial officer and concerns about the company as well as its links to China's authoritarian government are all part of that complicated environment. Still, officials in the U.S. and China are optimistic the two sides can reach a deal. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Monday that he is hopeful that in the coming days and weeks, there will be what he called a significant announcement. Speaking on the sidelines of Beijing's annual political meetings, China's Commerce Minister Zhongshan said the two countries still need to find some common ground.
At present, working teams are still continuing negotiations, as we still have a lot to do. Even more, we need China and the United States to meet halfway and work together.
During meetings of the National People's Congress this year, China is expected to pass its first foreign investment law. To support domestic companies as the economy slows, Li says China will cut company taxes and social insurance contributions by nearly $300 billion. He also says the government will lift spending and make its fiscal policy more forceful. Beijing will also increase its military spending by 7.5% this year to around $180 billion. Analysts say the actual figure is much higher, but based on the amount Beijing has disclosed, China's budget is still three times more than that of what India spends, but still far behind Washington, which spent almost $700 billion on defense last year. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Happening in Asia, millions of North Korean voters, including leader Kim Jong-un, went to the polls Sunday to elect roughly 700 members to the national legislature. In typical North Korean style, the vote was more of an endorsement than a competitive contest. Voters were presented with just one state-sanctioned candidate per seat. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we start out a brand new week. Here on VOA Asia, Australia has signed a free trade agreement with Indonesia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us this deal was in doubt back in October when Indonesia considered putting the imminent agreement on hold over Australia's controversial proposal to shift its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem.
Australia shares a long maritime boundary with Indonesia and has close security ties. But experts have said that the bilateral economic relationship has been underdeveloped. Australia hopes that will change after the signing of a long-awaited free trade agreement. It was delayed last year when Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison suggested he might move his country's embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. In response, Indonesia, a strong supporter of the Palestinian territories, considered putting the trade deal on hold. Australia later decided not to relocate its embassy in Israel, which has diffused much of the tension. Indonesia hopes the trade pact signed in Jakarta this week will give its people more opportunities to work in Australia, as well as support for its palm oil industry. The deal is expected to benefit Australia's agricultural and education industries. Australian universities and vocational training colleges will be allowed to operate in Indonesia. Its cattle farmers, grain growers, vegetable producers and steelmakers are also expected to benefit. Australian Trade Minister Simon Birmingham.
If you're a cattle producer across a flood-ravaged North Queensland or indeed the Northern Territory elsewhere around the country, you're going to see huge growth in access for both live and frozen beef and cattle. If you're working in the steel industry, you're going to see an opportunity for us to be able to export the equivalent of five Sydney Harbour bridges each and every year in terms of steel production.
The Business Council of Australia and the National Farmers Federation are both supporting the trade deal, but trade unions say it could damage Australian jobs by allowing more Indonesian workers into the country. The deal took 8 years to negotiate. Indonesia has the world's largest Muslim population and is home to 260 million people. Australia has a population of 25 million. Experts say the Australian-Indonesia pact is a timely signal to the international community about the importance of free trade. Australia has 10 free trade agreements currently in force, including accords with China, Japan and Korea. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, courageous women honored. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
latest news from VOA Asia. Sunday marked the 60th anniversary of Tibet's failed uprising against China. The abortive mission forced the Dalai Lama, Tibet's traditional Buddhist leader, into exile into mountainous India, where he established a Tibetan government in exile and launched his campaign for a free Tibet. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, First Lady Melania Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have paid tribute to 10 women from around the world with this year's International Women of Courage Awards. One of the honorees was from Myanmar, also known as Burma. She described her own personal experience as one of the many who, she says, endured brutality at the hands of her country's military forces. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from the State Department.
10 women were honored with the International Women of Courage Award at the State Department and thanked by America's First Lady, Melania Trump.
The women we are honoring today are a symbol of courage. They're human rights advocates in some of the most dangerous parts of our world, and they have pushed through gender-based stereotypes to serve the greater good.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also paid tribute, saying there are many other women like the winners whose courage may never be honored.
My mother, too, was a woman of courage. She was born in rural Kansas. She helped make ends meet while raising 3 kids. She never managed to get to college, but made sure that each of us had enormous opportunity.
One honoree has worked her entire life to support ethnic communities who continue to be displaced by the decades-long civil war in Burma, now Myanmar. She said she was born displaced and spent her childhood running or in refugee camps.
Imagine sending your 6-year-old girl in Thai village to go to school because it was not safe in your village. Imagine being an 11-year-old girl, coming home, see your village empty, family gone, being fled, and then spending days wandering from settlement to settlement, looking for your family. I was that 6-year-old girl, and I was that 11-year-old girl as well. At that time, the Burma army burned and destroyed more than 3,500 villages in southeast Burma and slaughtered many thousands of people.
Kenya Pa said Myanmar's military is still responsible for brutal violence against the Rohingya people and other ethnic groups and called on the international community to take action and not forget them. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This news from VOA Asia. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has called the legal clash between Chinese company Huawei and the United States government deliberate political suppression, and he vowed to protect the rights of Chinese companies and citizens abroad. Washington has banned U.S. companies from using Huawei technology. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, he's not quite a household name, but moviegoers have seen Patrick Kilpatrick in scores of action movies as police detective or maybe a bad guy. Mike O'Sullivan spoke with Kilpatrick about his 35 years in Hollywood as a character actor.
Hollywood, a dream for many. But for actor Patrick Kilpatrick, it's not about the glamour. It's a way to make a living.
It's like you're a gambler. You're kind of waiting for this golden hit to get the ring. And a couple of times I've had what I call Hollywood moments where, like Under Siege 2 with Steven Seagal, I was going through a divorce at the time and I was relatively down and out. I think I was down to $50. So my agent called and said, they want to hire you for this Under Siege 2. In Colorado.
And this offer of a role in the Rocky Mountain thriller put Kilpatrick back in the game. He has played opposite Jean-Claude Van Damme, Chow Yun-Fat, and nearly every action star as army privates and generals.
Or the senator, or whatever it is from starting out as the beat cop.
Kilpatrick is also a writer and has chronicled his life in Hollywood in a book. He says at times his writing skills have allowed him to expand his characters.
Any actor who starts out is going to be in some pretty not-so-great films. They're not going to be the pinnacle of cinematic art. So it's really good to be able to write your own lines and create your own stuff. A lot of times I've been hired as a thug, but they get a criminal mastermind.
At 69, Kilpatrick consults with young filmmakers and continues to act, but says that will end one day.
The business uses you until you're done. So you better be prepared for that. And that can be pretty abysmal in a pretty dark place if your whole being is based on acting or writing or whatever it is, because it's going to end.
But along the way, he says it's been quite a ride. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Hollywood.
Look at me. Positive for Howard Marks. I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder.
The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, words that evoke colorful images of lost riches, and while that debate continues over where those gardens were located or even if they existed at all, researchers have collected decades of research to produce what they claim is the most stunningly accurate portrayal of what the gardens may have looked like when they were built 2.5 millennia ago. Henry Ridgewell reports.
A garden known throughout the world for its beauty, a name now synonymous with the disappeared riches of an ancient kingdom. This animation is claimed to be the closest representation yet of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. The design by computer scientists from the University of Northampton is based on over 20 years' research.
It's not an artist's imagination. It doesn't come from an artist's imagination. It comes from archaeologists based on evidence.
The gardens were built by King Nebuchadnezzar II, ruler of the Neo-Babylonian Empire around 600 BC. Ancient Greek texts describe the gardens as one of the seven wonders of the world, suggesting they survived hundreds of years. Historically, they were thought to lie in the ancient city of Babylon, south of present-day Baghdad. But some scholars now believe they were located further north, in what is now Iraq's Nineveh province, around the city of Mosul.
We don't know exactly where the site is. I've made a suggestion. The site has been, it had many layers on top of the Assyrian things. We don't know how long the garden lasted.
Mosul and much of the surrounding area was devastated during the battle against Islamic State. Aided by the charity the Amar Foundation, which aims to rebuild communities torn apart by that conflict, the historians hope to build on this initial research.
It's positive and it has a social impact, which we are trying to emphasize on that, make the connection happen with the past, because people lose this connection because of the many wars they have, and this is unfortunate.
So could these virtual worlds one day be discovered in reality?
I don't actually think that it would be possible to find a garden now. We do have some quite good ground sensing equipment that might just help, but people will rob stones away and put them in their houses. So anything that was stone there has been robbed long ago.
Nevertheless, it's hoped the project will help to educate and inspire further appreciation of Iraq's rich cultural heritage. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. In case, however way you listen to us, you can't find our program, just check us out on VOA Asia Facebook or our website at voanews.com. And there you'll find all of our programs that you can listen to from today or from days past. We also are on the radio, Voice of Chung-Rung, Star Radio, FM 88.3 at Chung-Rung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in. Our thanks go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a terrific day.